From deep inside the Death Star, I'm Larry Larson.
I'm Andrew Richards.
And I'm Mark Rusinovich.
Special guest star. It's a very special episode of Defrag Tools today.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being here. Yeah. Absolutely. So we want to talk to you today about the history, the legends, some of the backstories about cis-internal tools.
Okay.
So let's start back at the beginning. How did this all start?
It started really back in 1996 with me and Bryce Cogswell, who I met getting my PhD. We started working on Windows stuff as part of offspin of our PhD research. So we became familiar with the internals of Windows, and I decided, hey, let's start writing some tools. So actually, one of the first tools we wrote was Regmon, which is part, you know, the process monitor is partly the successor to it.
I remember using that for years and years and years.
So registry filtering monitoring tool. FileMon, then we wrote FileMon. We wrote articles in Dr. Dobbs' journal about these tools. I wrote, started writing my own tools for myself. Like one of the tools that I think it was actually the first tool that I wrote for Windows, Control to Cap, which I still use today, which swaps the caps lock key into a control key because I'd done all my work up to that point on Unix and the Unix keyboards. That's the mapping, and so I just get a new PC, run Control to Cap, and I'm comfortable again.
So what happens to caps lock?
Caps lock, I
it doesn't
never,
exist.
Who uses caps lock? Do you use caps lock?
Not the caps lock, no.
Yeah. I don't want to yell
it's
at someone.
Shift key.
In Facebook, maybe.
Yeah, or Twitter. so I don't use the caps lock key. So it goes away. But that's the first tool. But so we were writing these tools and publishing them in Dr. Dobbs' journal. And I had a friend named Andrew Shulman, who people familiar with the old history of Windows know him from Undocumented DOS, a book he wrote.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then he also got in trouble with Microsoft for a book he wrote called Unauthorized Windows 95 Update. And he would, on his website, let us publish or post these tools. So we did that for a few months, and then I'd say, okay, here's a fix for these bugs. Andrew, can you put it up? And he'd take a week to get around to doing it, and so that got annoying. So I said, all right, let's make our own site. And that's NT Internals was founded in September of 1996.
Cool. Nice. And were there any tools that you started that you just never finished or didn't release?
Yeah, there's a whole bunch. And actually, there's roughly 70 tools right now, active sysinternals tools, but there's probably 20 tools that have been retired over time, either because their functionality has been folded into other tools or because I just don't see the value of maintaining them anymore. They don't apply really anymore to Windows. Windows has subsumed the functionality.
I think the one that I hear a lot about is Rootkit Revealer. You know,
yeah.
People say, well, why doesn't it work? It's like, well, that was ages ago. That was XP.
I just got asked about that yesterday.
Yeah, Twitter. I get asked a lot too from a support point of view.
But I think that one's still up there. I just like I'll just leave it up there and let it die a natural death.
Yeah.
Instead of yanking it, but there's been tons of tools. Here's one, a blast from the past, a tool I wrote called NTFrob. You know, frobnicate is a computer science term for messing with something. what NTFrob did, I started to develop these techniques of using the symbols that come with Windows to identify variables and functions inside of the kernel, inside of other DLLs and libraries. And then I could go and poke values directly, ones that weren't exposed by any API call.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the values that I found the symbol for was the quantum length for that the NT scheduler used to determine how long a thread should run once it gets a CPU. And so NTFrob would let you go and mess with that value, which some people could, you know, I don't know if anybody ever found that useful, but it was fun to write.
What's the most complex tool that you've done? The most time-consuming?
The one that I've sunk the most time into, without a question, is Process Explorer. Because that tool, I mentioned tools that have gotten retired because the functionality has been folded into other ones. Process Explorer is a combination of at least two tools, Handle EX, which was the handle viewing side of Process Explorer, and DLL View, which was the DLL viewing side. And then I mashed those two together. But those tools, I wrote the first versions of them in 97 or 98, and so Process Explorer was born somewhere around 2001 or 2, and then just probably at this point thousands of hours of work on this.
Yeah,
I think it's one of those tools which keeps on getting sucked up with other things. Like I know that you added auto runs to it this year. It's like there's more and more code is becoming the god of everything.
Yeah.
Definitely. What's your favorite tool? Which child is your favorite?
Yeah, that's a really tough one. I'd have to say Zoomit. because I use Zimit every day, actually. Mm. So I've got, you know, big monitors with tiny fonts, and even just if you get a web page, they for some reason different sites pick really small fonts. Even our own TechNet blogs, for some reason, our font sizes are really small. So what I'll do is just use Zimit to blow it up. Or if somebody comes into my office and I'm referring to an email or a document where I want to, you know, say, point out something to talk about, I'll zoom in on it, and so they can just sit there in their chair and see the text really easily. So
is that why you added Live Zoom? Is it because you're using it so much that you wanted to be more interactive?
Live Zoom was more for presentations, so you could zoom while you're messing with the demos at the same time instead of the static view. Mm-hmm. So it was really for that. But that one is fun because I used it a lot also presenting. When Dave Solomon and I were presenting Windows Internals, I got the whole magnifier scribbling thing from him. There was a OEM tool that came with one of the laptops that was a zooming tool that we'd use in the presentations, and I'd use that tool as well to zoom while I was doing Windows Internals training. But the tool had all these really quirks, like if you typed the keystrokes in the wrong order or not the right timing, then it wouldn't work reliably and you'd get stuck, and it was unintuitive sequences for picking the pens and things like that. So I was like, the hell with this stupid tool. It's really annoyed me way too much. And so that Zoomit was born in 2005. So I'm like, I'm just going to write my own tool. And that's what I do is a lot of times there's good ideas out there, but they're
it's
just
close,
not,
right?
Yeah, it's close.
It's close.
But the thing is I believe in very intuitive interfaces, ones that are easy to use. And so now I use Zoomit and it's second nature. I don't even realize what I'm doing with it because it's so easy to, you know, to get used to. And the user interface, once you see it, then you never see the interface again. Mm-hmm. So that was much more made my life much more pleasant teaching Windows Internals classes once I had that written.
Mm. Talking about Windows Internals, how did you get involved with the books?
I got involved with the Windows Internals book back in, well, I always knew that I wanted to write a Windows Internals book. Undocumented DOS, I thought was really cool. Mm-hmm. The VAX VMS internals, just really cool to have somebody just document the inner workings of a complex system like that in a way that was understandable and really showed an end-to-end understanding of the way the system worked. And I always found that teaching and writing is a great way to force yourself to learn. It's fantastic forcing function because I'm not a person that can stand up and talk about something if I don't understand it at a deeper level than what I'm actually explaining. Mm. And because you feel
that's
uncomfortable,
that's
right?
The,
it's like you're lying
about
or making something up.
That's
right?
The secret to public talking. You only talk about a proportion of what you know. Yeah. Never go up to your limit.
That's right. So I found that forcing function really nice, and I thought it'd be really cool to have to be an author on a Windows Internals tech. So I actually did a book deal with I can't remember the name of the company, IDG Press, to do a Windows Internals book. And I think there's certain sites where you can go look at it and look at Windows Internals, Marcus Cernovich, and find 1997, you know, ISBN number and everything, but it never came out. I just couldn't get the time to finish it.
It's NT4 era?
NT4, yeah. So I thought, so I met Dave Solomon, and he'd taken over from Helen Custer the first edition of Inside Windows NT, did the second edition, and it just made me so jealous when that book came out, and I saw it, and it was much better than the first one, and it had experiments in it that he'd added that really made you connect with the material. And so I said, hey, it'd be really awesome if I could just piggyback on top of this and just add to it rather than start from scratch and have to do all this work over again and then have a competing book. So I approached Dave about it, and he said, yeah. Interesting side story to that is, at the time, I was still repairing a reputation with Microsoft, my reputation with Microsoft, which I'd burned badly back in 96 over the NT workstation server thing. So when I approached Dave about it, he said, well, I have to ask Microsoft. So he went and came and asked people in the Windows team, and it went all the way to Jim Alchin, who was the group vice president or group of, you know, server and Windows, and he said, yeah, Mark can do it, but it's your butt if he screws up, because they didn't trust me at the time.
So. Yeah. So what was the decision made in the fourth edition to change it in the fifth edition to change it so it's just one version of Windows? Because up until the fourth edition, it's about every version all the way down to 3.1, really. And then, which is why I always say to people who are buying the books, you've got to have fourth, you've got to have fifth, and you've got to have sixth, because fourth is about 2003 XP, fifth is Vista in 2008, and 6 is 7 and R2. So why the change?
So that it forced you to buy more books. No, that's not the reason. Although it's a nice side effect of it. But the reason is, by the 5th edition, when we started writing it, and we started with the base of the 4th, which covered up to Windows Server 2003 and XP, we had sections like the scheduler, which were like, the scheduler behaves this way in NT4, it behaves this way in Windows 2000, it behaves this way in XP. On server, it's actually slightly different. On multiprocessors, it's different. And then when we were adding the Vista material, like, this is just out of control. Somebody looking at this is just going to have no idea what's going on. Especially when they might not even be interested in these older versions, and this is just noise in the system. So let's just focus on this. And that just cleaned up the whole book as far as us not having to go, this section's for this, that's for that. Oh, by the way, it works this way except for this particular version, you know, kinds of things through the book.
What's the best way to learn how to troubleshoot?
Do it.
Just do it. Try to just fix every problem you have.
That's right.
Do you think reading things helps at the same time, or is it kind of gets maybe too confusing with the extra detail?
I don't know. I haven't found troubleshooting books that I've read to help me troubleshoot. I've written the tools, so I know the tools. But I think somebody approaching it for the first time, certainly having an understanding of the way the system works, like that you'd get from Windows internals, is good. If you really want to be good at troubleshooting, you've got to have the foundational knowledge of the way the system works, plus you've got to have the experience of seeing the way the system works. There's nothing that replaces that you can't have somebody that, even using or troubleshooting for a few weeks, compared to somebody starting it the first day, even if they both have the same foundational knowledge, because somebody that's been doing it for a few weeks opens up Process Explorer and they immediately know what's standard, what's typical kind of behavior. Yeah. These processes are all normal. This one should be doing something. I expect that. Whereas
it's kind of like the Matrix, isn't it? You kind of get to a point where you go, that shape is kind of what I expect, and then you see it's something slightly different.
That's right. That's what troubleshooting is all about, is looking for anomalies and human, you know, pattern matching and anomaly detection that machines haven't gotten good at, at least not with systems that are these complex. And a lot of times it's intuition and digging into something that you suspect. One of the fascinating things to me about the cases people send me, because I ask people to send me troubleshooting cases, is I look at the way that they've stepped through the problem, and they just go off in weird directions, in my opinion, where they say, oh, I saw this symptom, so I ran this tool, and I looked at this, and I'm like, what would make you think of doing that? But then they get to some solution at the end anyway, even though it's not the approach that I would have suggested. Yeah.
So you've done a lot of security talks lately, and of course your books. Do traditional troubleshooting tools help with troubleshooting viruses?
Absolutely. It depends on the type of virus, but yeah. So Process Explorer, one of the things that I talk about in my malware troubleshooting talks where I use the sysinternals tools, is that Process Explorer, I never wrote really as a malware secure cybersecurity research tool. It was really just here's what the Windows system looks like. All the raw information here, it's right in your face. I'm not going to filter it. I'm not going to hide it. I really want to, and that was partly to support the Windows internals training. So we could say, the way the thread scheduler works like this, and here you can see the raw thread priorities. I'm not going to hide it with the Win32 names that obfuscate what's really going on underneath the hood. But the interesting thing is that those same tools are very useful for hunting malware too, because of the level of detail of information I've shown you. There are a few features, yes, that I've added specifically for malware hunting to the tools, but just a few.
So how's it that you've become this cyber expert in the last, I don't know, 3 or 4 years, I've kind of guessed?
Well, I've been a cyber expert for a long time.
But how come there's this public edifice of it? I mean, what's changed in the world that makes you want to talk about this stuff now?
As far as me talking about cybersecurity, that's been going on for a long time. We're just talking about Rootkit Revealer. Rootkit Revealer we wrote in early 2005. And I'd had an interest in cybersecurity from way before that. That was probably the first very security-focused tool that Bryce and I published. But I've been talking about it since then. In fact, in 2005, I think I gave my first tech ed talk on malware hunting. And the talk has morphed a lot since that time. It's gotten a little more advanced. It's, I think, better, improved over time. But that's when I started doing cybersecurity talks at conferences.
So is some of the point of writing the novels to just get better awareness out there, or is it more just to have a fun story to read?
For me, it's to be able to have fun writing a fun story, and have fun writing a story that I would want to read, and the books that I like to read aren't fantastical. Well, I'd like to read fantastical books that just kind of stretch the world as we know it and make big leaps. Mm. But I also like to read books that are really grounded in technology and solid technology. And I thought it'd be fun to write a book that really presented cybersecurity the way it really is, like where these stories could be real. There's a little bit of stretching here and there, but they could really...
Yeah, I know, I mean, from my point of view of being in support and having technology as a core of my job, reading those books, there's nothing that makes you go, oh, come on.
Yeah.
But every time you read it, you go, yeah, that's just a little bit too chilling. That's actually plausible. It could happen. It would take a lot of sequences of events to make it work, but it's chilling how actually... It just chills you. I can't put it down when I start reading it because I know how bad things can get, and I want to see whether it does get that bad.
Yeah. So you're—I mean—that's the perfect reaction that I was looking for from people like you that very much like me work in the space and want to read something where you're not gagging every five pages, going, "Okay,
yeah,
you know, suspend disbelief, massive suspension of disbelief here. Let me move on to the next page and see if I can get into back into the plot.
Yeah.
Rather stay in the story, no big suspensions of disbelief and." For somebody that's not familiar with the space, really, like, what's going on? We hear headlines of anonymous attacks. We, you know, Stuxnet made the headlines in New York Times. Like, what's behind it? What, you know, the stories that really take you behind it? Plus, just a fun story. Really.
What should people be doing, both individually and, you know, for their corporations that they work for, to prepare for these cyber threats?
So... Actually, so there was a, I went to RSA this year, and Carl Mueller, the head of the FBI, he had this great quote. I think his name is Carl. Mueller is his last name. But he had this great quote. There are two types of company in this world. Those that have been hacked and those that will be hacked. And all of them will be hacked multiple times. So everybody should be prepared for this. If you look at the scenario in Zero Day, the malware wipes out data. And we actually saw a real case of this kind of malware, targeted attack at a major corporation, Saudi Aramco, just 2 weeks ago, where they came out and they talked publicly about the fact that 30,000 of their systems were infected with malware that was trying to wipe the boot sector and delete a bunch of files.
Huh.
And they've managed to clean it up. They went off the internet for a week. They said they cleaned it up and then came back on the internet. So that's a real scenario. And if you haven't backed up your data, you're screwed. And I think that backups, of course, are just great hygiene no matter what. If your server fails, if you know the building gets catches on fire, that to have backups of your data is important. And I think a lot of people don't know if their data is backed up. Cases even in Microsoft where we've got servers that we think are being backed up normally, and then it's like, oh, crap, the servers, you know, the software that's supposed to be checking to make sure that the servers are being backed up, actually, that's been misconfigured for some time, and nobody knew it. And so... Or nobody was seeing the alerts that were generated, and crap, we've been running without a backup for 3 months. You know, so I think that it's probably really prevalent out in the world where they're not even as rigorous as how we try to be. So
are backups safe, though? Because you could be backing up the virus itself,
actually,
right?
Actually, Zero Day, I have got that scenario. They're backing up the virus itself, too, in Zero Day. But it's better than nothing. And actually, it's not necessarily the system, but the data that... It's important. Any scenario you think of for, like, you're totally screwed could happen, but the chances are smaller, you know, for really extreme cases like that.
Is there a case to move more backups into a cloud scenario these days than the traditional tape type way? Is it more efficient and more effective way of approaching disaster recovery?
I personally think so. I mean, and we actually just released as a feature for DPM and Server 2012 is backup to Windows Azure of your servers. The benefits of the cloud is that we're very rigorous about making sure that the backups are triplicated, that we've got disaster recovery in place, so that's actually being synchronized between two data centers if you want to. So even if there's a geo incident, you're safe.
Mm-hmm.
The data is constantly being scrubbed and refreshed, so does disks go bad and wear out, have sector problems, you're not losing data as well. Mm-hmm. If you're doing it yourself, then you don't have that kind of assurance. Plus, it's accessible from anywhere, you know, so there's a lot of benefits, I think, to backing up to the cloud.
I think from a home point of view, I have this advice for everybody is that don't leave your backups at home.
Yeah.
Or even worse, next to your PC, right? Lots of people do that, and unfortunately, I've had friends who've lost their entire life because they left their backup disk next to the PC when it was stolen.
Yeah.
And my biggest thing is just put it in a safe deposit box, put it at a friend's house, put it at your parents' house, whatever.
Yeah.
But don't
put it in the cloud.
Or put it in the cloud, right? But just don't have it at home. And SkyDrive is the answer to that these days. I mean, SkyDrive, it's relatively cheap, lots of capacity, and just put everything in the cloud and just let Microsoft worry about the integrity of it.
But to continue the answer to your question, Larry, about what companies can do to prepare, I've been a strong, strong believer in whitelisting technology since early 2000s. This is another case where at Winternals, me and Bryce had prototype projects and that we went off and tried to figure out how to make a whitelisting solution that would be palatable to companies. Mm-hmm. One of the problems with whitelisting is that it's very rigid. So you set this policy of what software can run on the system, what's allowed to run and what's not allowed to run. Most businesses, including small and medium businesses, aren't so rigorous that they've got a central IT shop that's pushing software updates. They've got end users on desktops, like the head of the marketing department saying, oh, let's go to buy this software package, and they download it and then run it, and they don't want to necessarily have to go to somebody else for permission to run it. So we developed a software whitelisting product right before the acquisition to Microsoft, mm-hmm. and now we've got AppLocker and Windows 7 kind of evolution of that technology integration into Windows. But if there's one security technology that I would say that if you really care about the security of your systems, the biggest bang for your buck is whitelisting. Mm-hmm. Because even if malware does get on your machine, 99% of malware or more, 99.9% of malware out there today requires the ability to drop files on your system and then execute them to persist. And whitelisting completely defeats that. Mm. You combine that with secure launch technology, and then it becomes impossible for malware that's even aware of the whitelisting to turn off the whitelisting and circumvent it that way. And we've got secure launch technology in Windows 8. And you combine that with curation of what's in the whitelist rather than having your end users decide what's in it. You have something like a store, marketplace, an IT-run marketplace even, saying these are the software packages you can put on your system. We approve them. We trust the digital signature that comes with them so that when you download it, it'll just work. And that keeps your systems clean. Now, the excuses that I always heard is end users using their PCs at work, they like to download crap off the web and run it, and this will really annoy them if they get locked down. But what do you care about more? Your end users being able to screw around on work time on your PCs at work, or actually keeping
integrity.
Your system safe
and
secure?
I think you did a talk called something like Security Boundaries or something, where you go through a lot of this stuff. And I think USC was the classic one where people think it's a security boundary and it's not. Can you maybe elaborate on
that particular one? So when I got to Microsoft, I saw the interesting problem with the way UAC was being presented internally, and then I knew that as Vista drew closer to launch, that if we didn't fix things, then it would get out externally misrepresented. And that was that when you run with UAC on, you're protected from malware that requires admin rights. And even simplified further, you're protected from malware once you've got UAC on. Because anytime malware wants to run, you'll see this pop up and you'll be able to look at it and say, no, I don't want to run the malware. Mm. And that was kind of the idea. What I immediately came in and showed was that that's not true. Even for malware that wants to run admin, if it's aware of UAC, it could hijack the UAC prompt in different ways. For one, that UAC prompt doesn't show you the command line unless you click it open. Second, there's command lines for applications that you run on a regular basis that support syntaxes that you're not familiar with, so you don't know what the hell this command line is potentially going to do. It's not going to be something as obvious as del, slash s star dot star, but MMC snap-ins, for example. You elevate one of those, and it's got this funky command line or control panel applet.
And I also assume that you even understand what that means. I mean, the vast majority of users have no
idea. They have no idea. I'm even going benefit of the doubt to somebody that's actually somewhat sophisticated. But then the other ways to hijack it are the signature information is only on the primary executable that's asked for elevation. Mm. None of the ancillary components that it'll pull in, like the DLLs, that it's statically linked against or it'll dynamically linked against, are checked. So if you mess with a vulnerability where it's got a weak DLL search path, or you launch it from a directory that's insecure, that's where you drop the DLL right there and it's going to pull a DLL from the local directory, you can infect. You're getting the user to prove the elevation of a process that has a malicious DLL as part of it, yet it'll have this nice, everything's fine, it's signed, trusted by the system kind of dialog box on it. So I actually, the only way to drive those kinds of points home with people, unfortunately, is to write them, you know, show examples, to actually show them in their face. Like, so I wrote a tool that would hijack elevations, and ones that would give you a fake UAC prompt and then capture your credentials and then do launch malware under again. So that convinced people, okay, this really isn't secure. And I haven't even gone to the five other, you know, half dozen other reasons that that malware can fool you.
It's mainly social engineering these days. I mean, social engineering is, I don't know what the stat is, but I'm sure it's a large proportion of the reason why.
And I always said, you know, like, if malware got on your system and it marked IE as requiring elevation, how many end users do you think wouldn't just click on the orange IE once admin rights dialog box? Mm-hmm. Everybody would.
Yeah.
I mean, I guarantee lots of sophisticated users would as well.
Well, you'd think it must be some plugin or something that I installed, and it's just, you know, asking for the elevation.
Yeah, and so it's orange, but it says IE, so I don't know
what
that means.
I trust IE.
Yeah. And the only way for me to even research if this is a problem or not is to go to the web. Well, and how do I do that without IE? So that was kind of like forcing somebody into a box, like you've got to press this if you want to use your computer.
Yeah.
So anyway, there's lots of other examples like that where I showed UAC isn't giving the value that a lot of people were claiming it's giving. And so that related in Windows 7 of the fact that by default you don't have to elevate or press a button for elevation of the built-in Windows binaries. Because really the fundamental reason for UAC's existence isn't to be an anti-malware solution. It is to get us to a world where we have our systems separating user and system, and that enables a more secure system. If you have your end users as user, they can't, a more secure and reliable system. Your end users can't mess with the system, they can't mess with the policies, they can't turn off the firewalls, and if malware does infect their account, you still got this bastion of hope that's the system where the anti-malware engine's running and can potentially clean it off or identify it.
A lot of malware these days is just purely user credentials, too. You don't have to be administrator for it to persist in a box anywhere, right?
That's a joke I make, is that what UAC tried to do is train software developers, ISVs, to write their programs to run a standard user. Well, malware writers are ISVs, too, and so they've been trained as well. And so that's one of the changes from my original 2005 talk, where I have this recipe of how you look at your system and look for signs of malware.
Yeah.
One of them was unsigned binaries or binaries without any description or company name that are sitting in your Windows directory, Windows System 32, or program file, or actually Windows or Windows System 32, because most malware doesn't stick themselves in program files, they just drop themselves right in the Windows directory.
Go for gold.
But part of the recipe has changed, because now more and more malware sticks itself in your user profile under app data roaming in there. So that's the other place now you've got to look if you see something there.
I suppose that, you know, because the web page is running as lower integrity and you go to your bank site at lower integrity, malware only needs lower integrity to scrape your password when you type that in, right?
Yeah.
So you don't need to be God.
Yeah, that's the point of, and actually I gave one of these talks at a security conference on UAC to try to get the word out, especially to the security research community, because what we didn't want is UAC coming out and then security researchers going, Microsoft saying this thing is anti-malware, it's a security boundary, and look, we just found out five different ways to punch holes in it. Because then we've got to come out and say, no, you didn't understand, we that's not what we meant, but rather be proactive about this, like, look, nothing to see here, move along, because this is not what you hope that it would be for you to go have fun with and get an article about yourself for. But one of the quotes that I made was, what you're going to see is malware, you're going to see more and more standard user malware. Well, of course, the press likes quotes like that, because they throw it out and then it comes across as you're going to see more and more malware. Mark Rusinovich from Microsoft says you're going to see more and more malware for Windows. So,
well, you said it.
Yeah, but that's not what I meant.
So can you talk about some of the changes in Windows 8?
I cannot.
Okay, then. Done deal.
Well, it was partial time, right? I mean,
what's that?
You left.
I left during the planning of it. So before the coding actually started, I went to Windows Azure. Mm-hmm.
So what's the difference between WinTernals, Windows internals, and sysinternals?
Windows, Windows internals, WinTernals, and sysinternals.
Yeah.
Okay, Windows internals is the name of the book.
This guy?
Yeah. And that is like the internals of the Windows operating system.
And there's a sixth edition out too.
Sysinternals is the freeware website that Bryce and I started. We talked about it at the beginning. Yep, that's that. That was originally called ntinternals.com until a certain company's lawyers told us that they didn't like us using the letters NT in the name of the website, so we changed it to sysinternals from ntinternals. And that's always been free software, free utilities. And then WinTernals is the name of the commercial software company that Bryce and I started. About just a couple weeks after we put up NT Internals, we founded WinTernals, and that's where we would sell software very similar to stuff we were posting on NT Internals, but commercial software. We'd have support, and we'd ship it and take orders and get money. And that's what, when Microsoft made the acquisition in 2006, they bought both WinTernals and SysInternals. They're both separate legal entities. Acquired the IP for both of those.
Cool. So what changes have you made for Windows 8 in the tools, in the SysInternals tools? What's happened? What's the new things that you've had to adjust for in Windows 8?
Well, one of them you've made to one of the SysInternals tools, ProcDump.
Came out this week.
So support for modern apps in that. And Process Explorer, there's been a number of things I've added for modern apps. So showing the app container, showing the capability SIDs and the token. Showing the app container SID in the token as well. And so that's one tool where there's been a number of Windows 8 changes. The other one where there's been Windows 8 changes is App Access Check, which is a tool that lets you see effective write access permissions on different objects in the system, files, registry keys. You can say, who has access to this registry key? Or even dump the raw ACL for this registry key. It also lets you look at processes and tokens, so you can say, what's the token of this process look like? So if you can point it at a modern app, and it'll show the same kinds of information. It'll also show you claims, too, so it understands token claims, which are part of the claims-based access control feature that's in Windows 8. So I guess I'm talking a little bit about Windows 8.
But
so that's another one. And then there's been tweaks to things, like desktops still isn't fully compatible with Windows 8. Actually, I could claim that it was compatible with Windows 7 and prior because a lot of people didn't use the Windows key to do things. And you had the start menu on the secondary desktop, so you could go start menu, run, start menu, launch program. Now with a Windows 8 system that doesn't have a working Windows key is crippled. It's useless. So desktops doesn't work right now on Windows 8, really, the secondary desktops, because the Windows key isn't supported, so I've got to fix that.
Yep. What happened back in the old schools when like UAC turned up? Did you have to do a massive rewrite of a lot of things when that type of stuff, when Vista came along?
Not really. I mean, did I have to do a rewrite? I had to add manifest to some tools. So some tools that required admin rights that Vista has heuristics to identify software that without a manifest that might require admin rights. But lots of my tools don't meet the heuristics, like the word setup. In their name of the program is one of them. So I had to add manifests so that when you ran them, they would elevate if they did require admin rights. The other change that I made was to tools like Process Explorer and Process Monitor to let you run them admin or standard user. So Process Monitor, if you get a log file from somebody and you double-click on it, you don't require elevation to go look at it.
Okay, yeah.
So that's a change in behavior. So the tool actually has some code paths where it says, am I opening a file? And versus doing live monitoring, starting out, I'm not going to ask for elevation at this point. So it's some changes like that.
Are you thinking about a seventh edition to the book or a supplement to cover Windows 8?
I'm not going to be working on that. Actually, the sixth edition is the last one. Azure is really where I'm focused now, so that's where I'm going to be spending my energy.
Inside Windows Azure internals?
People have asked me, even people in Windows Azure say, well, when's the Windows Azure internals book going to come out? And the problem with Windows Azure is it's changing so quickly that the two things. One, it's changing very quickly. Second, the integration that apps have with the platform is not to the level of depth at this point that apps do with the operating system of Windows. So there's limited, I see limited value for writing about Windows internals. I do Windows Azure internals. I do have a Windows Azure internals talk, but it's kind of like a little bit different spin than Windows internals. And I actually learned this the hard way. I'd started, when I did Windows internals talks, like Server 2008 R2 would come out or Server 2008 would come out.
Which I think is the highest rating Channel 9 video still.
Oh, yeah, 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 the Channel 9 interview that I did on that.
Yeah.
But for my tech ed talks that I co-author with Dave Solomon, we would say, okay, let's take a look at the Windows release and look at the system, the kernel and the low-level components, and talk about what's changed. And it'd just be this kind of big list of different featurelets. Mm. And we'd categorize them. Oh, these are performance-related. These are scalability. These are security. And then we'd just do a presentation where I'd talk about the new feature like UAC and then show a demo of how UAC works and then move on to the next thing.
Yeah.
And those were always really highly rated talks. Well, so I thought I could do the same thing with Windows Azure internals. I just come up and talk about the way that Azure works under the hood. And there were some people that love that, and other people that are like, okay, that's nice. So what?
So okay, it doesn't affect my
life.
Yeah,
exactly. So I had to take a different spin. At TechEd Europe, I actually changed the approach for that talk to say, okay, here's something about the way Windows Azure works under the hood, and here's how you can take advantage of that information to make your Azure app better. Mm. So that's the approach that I think works better. And that's required for two reasons. One is the people just, they know Windows. It's like a built-in expectation of what they're going to get and what they've come for. When you say Windows Azure internals, well, I'll actually ask the audience, how many of you actually deployed on Windows Azure and a Windows Azure app? And over half of them haven't. And over 60% of that half doesn't even know what Windows Azure is or the cloud is. So yeah. I've got to start kind of back.
You start back at like NT3.1 days.
Yeah.
What is Windows?
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of like that.
Like the basics.
So.
Yeah.
Are there any tools you've got in development that we can talk about now or any other ones that you want to work on?
One tool that I've got in development, it's called PSPing. It's and this I wrote, it's my first Azure tool that was really motivated by Azure. Mm-hmm. Because one of the things that we're looking at is performance in Azure. One of the things I spend my time on is how can we get good performance, not just good performance, but consistent performance. Because customers, when they run an application in Azure, they'd like it to behave the same way on Tuesday as it does on Wednesday. And so there's a lot of work for us to do there, any public cloud provider actually, a lot of work to do. It's a very hard problem. But one of the most, the foundational aspect, foundational resource in the system is the network in the cloud. Mm. So one of the things I was interested in is measuring latency between different points in Windows Azure, as well as bandwidth, as well as doing pings, as well as how long it takes to do a TCP connect to an endpoint, both from outside of Azure and inside of Azure. And so I had started to look around the web for tools, and I couldn't find tools that would do millisecond resolution, that would do histograms, the kinds of things that I wanted. And internally, we've got a tool that does latency measurements that comes from the Azure networking team, and we've got a tool that does bandwidth measurement that comes from the Windows team. Mm-hmm. But the user interfaces, the command line options on those are so ridiculous that it's one of those it's one of those things where it's like, okay, what was that? Dash A, what then? Dash M, this number, that number, comma, that number. I got to do that on the server side. Now go to the client side, and I got to do half those things again. And at the same time, I'm not sure what it's really doing underneath the hood. So that's one of those kind of zoom in moments where I said, all right, I'm just going to write tool to rule them all and make it really easy to use and does the things that I want it to do. And so that's PSPing. So you can set up the server and say, listen on this IP address and port. Then on the client, you can say, do a latency test, do a bandwidth test, and just do it over and over and generate histograms that you can import into Excel. You can do ICMP pings that are sub-millisecond resolution. You can do TCP connect pings. So that tool.
I know that RAMAP and VMAP fell into the same category. There was just nothing out there that gave it to you easy.
Yeah.
And you just finally snapped one day, I think, and got those things written.
Yeah. Well, actually, that reminds me of one of the ways that tool ideas come to me is Windows comes out and I'm looking at the new APIs and feature sets and say, oh, here's a new API. Well, I should just use it and show what that shows. Show what the API shows. RAMAP, Alex Ionescu had written this tool for Windows Internals 5th edition called Meminfo. It's a command line tool that would dump some of the information returned by the Superfetch APIs, undocumented internal APIs that integrated with the memory manager to show you information about physical memory usage. And the tool was a little bit cumbersome to use. So Bryce and I sat down. I said, Bryce, we need to make a nice, easy-to-use tool because I think this will be more useful for troubleshooting and for Windows internals training. Mm-hmm. If people want to see graphically what's going on, where is their RAM going? So that's the way that tool
we use those two particularly a lot in support. Ever since they've come out, they get used a lot. Like particularly the Windows team where I'm in, we use those tools a lot. It's just really the only way of getting a nice instantaneous snapshot of the memory without really hurting the box.
Yeah.
Everything else tends to be like, all right, we'll take a dump of your box, 96 gig, we'll be offline for 2 hours, it'll take 14 hours to upload it. You know, it's just not. It just wasn't a good story before then. So
yeah,
great tools.
Great.
Yeah, there's a certain fun feeling of writing a tool and then using it myself and going, wow, this is really intuitive and smooth. And
Yeah,
it's fun.
So we're going to give away a copy of your book.
Yeah.
How we're going to do this, let's see. About a week after this gets posted, you go through the comments, pick your favorite comment. That person's going to get your book.
That sounds a great idea.
Yeah, so we'll do that. So leave an awesome comment on the video, and you might get a signed...
Yeah, and a way for us to contact you so that I can find out where you live and send you the book.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for being here today and talking about this.
Yeah, it's been fun.